Good afternoon, and welcome to Coastal Conversations, here on WERU. We explore issues facing Maine's coastal communities through dialogue with people who live, work, and play on our coast. From fisheries to tourism, from energy to environment, from economy to ecology, we go beyond the social media soundbites, probing deeply into complex issues and solutions. Coastal Conversations is supported by Maine Sea Grant, in partnership with the Skudik Institute and the First Coast. My name is Tegan Paulson. Cod are perhaps the most influential fish in the history of the Atlantic Ocean. The fish were once prolific. In fact, one early account describes a school of fish so thick, the writer considered walking to shore from the ship just by stepping on codfish. Part of the reason there were so many is that cod will eat just about anything that fits in their mouth. The forage on everything from young lobsters to herring, capelin, and shrimp. Cod can grow to be over 100 pounds and will live more than 20 years. They're so iconic to New England's history that a wooden effigy of the fish has hung above the Massachusetts House of Representatives since at least 1747. Today, that incredible abundance that people enjoyed 300 years ago is a daydream. Cod have not visited Maine's bays in those numbers in at least two centuries. The fishery collapsed almost entirely in the 1990s, but overfishing began much earlier. To get to the beginning of the story, we need to travel all the way back to medieval Europe, before 1450 AD. But don't listen to me. Listen to this guy.
My name is Matthew McKenzie. I'm a professor of history and maritime studies at the University of Connecticut at the Avery Point campus. And I served on the Connecticut as the Connecticut obligatory delegate to the New England Fishery Management Council.
Matt McKenzie grew up in New England. The fishing pier in his hometown was on his way to school. So Matt watched the ground fish boats stop leaving the harbor. They were the final moments of a story that began over 500 years earlier. As early as the 1600s, Europeans were struggling to catch enough codfish in their home waters.
I mean, it was the reason why Europeans came to the Northwest Atlantic. A lot of people, there's a lot of debate right now going on between whether or not it was serial depletion that started in the medieval period and as populations recovered from various plagues and things like that, that basically Europeans just started pushing further and further and further west looking for cod. That's Jeff Bolster's thesis. But basically, the reason why Europeans came up here in the first place was to catch fish.
By the 15th century, Europe was recovering from the plagues, so there were more people to feed. Fishermen caught their local stocks and began going further and further afield, eventually to North America. Most of Western Europe went to the New World, but not all went to stay. The Spanish and French, for example, didn't even have to get off the boat. They had ample supplies of cheap salt, so they could preserve their fish right on board. Then they'd sail back to Europe and they'd sell it.
Cod just basically give up when they hit a hook. And so you haul them aboard and you chuck them onto the deck. And then at the end of the fishing shift, people would head split and then salt the fish and pack them down below.
The Spanish and French worked from ocean-going ships. But remember, the English couldn't afford as much salt. To save money, the English set up racks onshore to air dry their catch. It only finished it off with a bit of salt after several days on the rack. To do this, English fishermen set up small settlements along the coast. Instead of fishing from ships, they worked in dories near the shore.
The English had an inshore fishery by the 16th century that was a little different because they didn't have access to the supplies of cheap salt. They had to rely upon air drying for a good amount of the moisture removal.
The first fishing stations were on islands, both for protection from indigenous folks and to be closer to the fish. Monhegan had its first settlement in 1610, and they spread from there, all up and down the coast of Maine. Over time, ports in the southern Gulf of Maine became the major touch points for the offshore fleet. Somewhere along the line, there was a rebellion, a new country was formed, and people kept fishing. By the 1830s, the United States is bickering with Great Britain and Canada over cod and other fisheries. In fact, there are actually gunfights over bait and fishing grounds between American and Canadian fishermen. and crucially, the cod stocks of the Northwest Atlantic are showing signs of depletion. The offshore fleet can't just toss lines over the side anymore. Ships out of ports like Gloucester and Portland had to adapt, so instead of reaching the fishing grounds and tossing over a line, they reached the fishing grounds and they spread out.
As they started to perceive declines in stocks on the Scotian Shelf, they started to use dories to allow themselves to spread out their hook footprint. And this is what Karen and Bill used to work on a lot, Karen Alexander and Bill Leavenworth.
We'll hear from Karen later on. Dory fishing became one of the quintessential images of the New England cod fishery. The larger vessels acted as motherships, waiting for the return of their crews out in rowboats. And there are terrifying stories about fishing from these dories. You're on the big ocean in a tiny wooden rowboat, and at any point, a fog bank or a squall could leave you stranded there. And sometimes, just often enough that it couldn't be ruled out as a possibility by the folks back home, these lost fishermen survived. They'd run into another ship, wind up in Spain or France or Halifax, and eventually catch a ride home. All this made dory fishing an immensely stressful practice.
They did that for a few years, and then they saw the French fleet using these long lines, and by 1858, 1859, you see them starting to adopt that.
Long lines are where access to bait becomes really important. Suddenly, a small group of fishermen can put out hundreds of hooks. The number of hooks per fisherman explodes, and they need bait, which by the 1830s is much more available. The mackerel fishery, a bait fishery, is using nets from boats, a big improvement on a mobile fishing wares. And though cod stocks are showing signs of overfishing through the mid-1800s, there is still an impressive amount of cod in the ocean.
Compared to today, those stocks were, you know, abundant beyond all get out. The other complicating issue, though, if you're going to bring in the economics, is the revocation of the salt bounty.
The salt bounty was a federal fisheries subsidy approved by Congress in 1792. It lasted for almost 75 years.
That basically paid fishermen a kickback or a bounty to offset the higher price of salt that they would have to pay because salt was taxed as it was imported. And so because that would hit that industry disproportionately hard, Congress approved a compensation mechanism that would pay fishermen for their added overhead costs.
Basically, Congress put heavy tariffs on salt. The federal government didn't collect income taxes until the Civil War, so tariffs were the only way to raise money. But Congress realized the salt tariff would hit fishermen especially hard, so they authorized a bounty for cod. Fishermen could be paid a subsidy to offset the cost of salt, but there were some restrictions. You couldn't employ foreigners, and you had to fish exclusively for cod, nothing else. New England congressional delegations defended the bounty from the slave states for some time, but eventually it was the fishing industry itself that did the bounty in. Large fishing companies, ones that owned dozens of vessels, began to lobby against it.
The reason why the Massachusetts interests wanted the bounty to die was that, one, it was keeping competitors in the market and driving down the price of fish, and they didn't want that. But two, it was preventing them from taking advantage of immigrant labor, especially Canadian labor, and it limited their ability to prosecute other fisheries with the same vessels. If you went out for a cod trip and then went for mackerel, which was a far more profitable fishery, you didn't qualify for the salt bounty.
The bounty was repealed in 1866. Within decades, many small fishing ports collapsed and disappeared. Cod fishing consolidated into major hubs like Gloucester, Salem, and Beverly. Some groups seized on the collapse of the outports for political purposes. They blamed immigration, urbanization, and the Industrial Revolution.
What they don't realize is that, nope, this is just good old-fashioned industry on industry, you know, factionalism. You know, the fishing community chose to do this to itself.
The end of the bounty in 1866 marked the end of an era in which cod fishing was a way for basically anyone to earn a living on the water. But in its last 15 years, it gave a gift to future historians. Congress began requiring catch reports in the 1850s, seeking to gather information about the people earning the bounty. The reports detailed vessel size, the number of fish caught, the names and occupations of each crew member. The cod logs, as they are now called, contained a wealth of information about the fishery. They are central to our understanding of Maine's codfish industry in the 1800s, and their rediscovery is mostly thanks to a group of researchers who ran across the logs in the 2010s. Karen Alexander was part of that group. She says while Massachusetts was sending ships to the Grand Banks, George's Bank, and the Scotian Shelf, most Mainers were fishing within 25 miles of shore. Here's Karen.
People could go home for church, and they could go home to get the hay in, and they could go home to vote, and nobody died. And when we were studying the Frenchman's Bay fisheries, we found out that the worst thing that ever happened was some guy got seasick, and they had to take him in and put him on shore because he just wasn't going to make it as a sailor, and that was it.
Inshore fishing at the time relied heavily on landmarks. By triangulating compass bearings to spots on shore, fishermen could locate fishing grounds. Some spots were barely the size of a school classroom. But importantly, Maine fishermen were there to exploit the salt bounty. And in fact, some Mainers found a way to basically cheat the government out of its money. Bounty payments weren't based on the number of fish caught. They were based on the size of the vessel doing the fishing. So some people bought huge boats that weren't fit for the open ocean anymore and just anchored them near shore.
They were just making the minimum of the legal requirements to catch the bounty, but they weren't really fishing for the bounty. And the people who were doing that were the people in Frenchman's Bay. And they would get these big vessels, and there was one vessel that we knew of from the Beverly logs that was named the Mechanic, and it was 130 tons. It was a whopper. And it fished, you know, it fished way far out when it was in Beverly. And then it got to be old, and somebody, you know, bought it as a scrap vessel. And they anchored it in Blue Hill Bay. And they go out and fish on it a couple of days a week. And they caught like 4,000 fish, which is nothing.
These vessels and their crews are fishing right inshore. Here, let me give you a sense of how much they were catching. In 2023, New England's commercial fishermen landed a little over 1 million pounds of cod. In 1880, the Frenchman Bay area alone landed 6.5 million. Catches remained high for decades, thanks largely to the widespread introduction of otter trawls and engines. But beneath the surface, the fish weren't doing well. Bay by bay, they began to disappear. What we know now is that cod live in relatively exclusive subpopulations. These subpopulations migrated and spawned together. They didn't interact much with other groups. So when one bay got fished hard, cod from other areas didn't just fill in the empty space. They'd keep homing to the spots they'd always gone.
Now we know, and we do know, that cod come back and they spawn in the same place. You know, time and time again, we know that herring spawn in the same place. This, you know, 50 years ago, scientists would have said that this was totally crazy, even though fishermen recognized that there were visible differences in cod from different spawning areas. And there were visible differences sometimes in herring. And you know, a lot of scientists said, well, you know, that can't happen because these are migrating species and they don't home to places like salmon and aleyes. Well, now we know that that's wrong.
What's important to understand about fishermen is that their job is catching fish. It's how they make money. So when a local fishery collapses, it's basically like getting laid off. You need to go find work elsewhere. If it gets harder to find fish in one spot, you might move to a different location or try a new technology. To be a successful fisherman, you have to be able to adapt.
You know, so you see this happening again and again. And then you see it going from one species to another. Sometimes, you know, you've got the technology, you've got the fishing grounds and the location, but the fish aren't there anymore. So you go from cod to haddock to redfish, and then the redfish die, and then you go to rosefish, which are another name for redfish, and then they die. And so you fish each one of these different species down because they're what you have, and they're your money fish.
Ecological changes can occur on a timeline that far exceeds the life of a human being. People in the early 1800s, for example, would have a very different idea of what abundance looks like than folks in the 1970s. In academic circles, this difference is referred to as shifting baselines, or sometimes shifting baselines syndrome.
You see people moving to new locations, and the discovery of America is a kind of moving on because the fisheries in England and all of Europe really had been overfished. Whales had been overfished in the Middle Ages. And so all the people looking for whales came over to, you know, to Red Bay, and then the cod fishermen came over to the Grand Banks, and then they kept on. Then they would overfish the Grand Banks a little bit. The fish were getting smaller. They were caught farther and farther from shore, so they came to the Scotian Shelf, and then they overfished the Scotian Shelf, and then they found America.
You're listening to WERU Community Radio at 89.9 FM and streaming online at weru.org. This is Coastal Conversations. The fishing industry carried on. In the 1920s, it was still possible to catch hundreds of pounds of cod and haddock every day without even leaving the harbor. Fishing pressure really ratcheted up after World War II. European powers were seeking sources of food for a devastated continent. The Soviets and their satellites in particular came in large numbers. Their technology was awesome in its ability to take fish from the sea. Huge factory ships acted as processing facilities for squadrons of large draggers. This is Ted Ames, a fisherman from Stonington, talking in 2018 about the foreign fleets in the 1950s.
There were plenty of fish, and you could see early in the morning, you could see the whole solid landscape was lit. And that was the Russian fleet working through the area. We laughed. We said, the fish have come up inside. They missed them.
Wow.
But the next year, they hadn't.
These factory ships Ames is talking about did immense damage to cod stocks. At the time, Maine's fishermen were still mostly small scale. They'd keep their draggers closer to shore, letting large vessels fish the banks. Sentiment against foreign ships grew, and in 1977, a coalition of congressional delegates from the coastal states pushed through the Magnuson Act. Magnuson did two major things for U.S. fisheries. First, it established the exclusive economic zone. This gave the U.S. dibs on the fish and minerals in the ocean out to 200 miles from shore, addressing the problem of factory ships. Second, it dumped money into fisheries innovation, seeking to modernize U.S. fishing fleets. Dozens of new vessel designs hit the water, and electronic navigation revolutionized access to fishing grounds. And in the thick of it, representing a self-founded newspaper, was Robin Alden.
I'm Robin Alden, former commissioner and various other things involved in fisheries.
Robin moved to Stonington in the early 1970s. In 73, she founded Commercial Fisheries News, which she returned to after a three-year stint as DMR commissioner from 1995 to 1997. Initially, the paper focused on reporting management conversations. In the 1980s, Robin heard fishermen from eastern Maine raising the alarm about their groundfish stocks.
It was overfished, and the depletion happened earlier in the Gulf, particularly in the eastern Gulf of Maine, before it did off of Massachusetts. So it was destroyed in two ways. One was the fragility of the system in light of modern technology, and the second was the compensating regulations were grossly unfair.
The regulations Robin is referring to include a days at sea system. This was implemented by the New England Fisheries Management Council. The council, created by the Magnuson Act in 1976, is one of eight councils across the country with the responsibility of managing many federal fisheries on a regional basis. The council stepped in when, in the 1990s, it became clear to all that groundfish stocks were suffering depletion. Groundfish includes cod, but also species like haddock and flounder. The New England Council instituted a days at sea system, in which fishermen were allocated a certain number of days every year that they were allowed to catch fish. This number was determined by how many days the fishermen had spent on the water over a recent period. But eastern Maine started losing their fishery before this period, and most couldn't afford to spend as many days on the water as boats from southern New England.
No one believed that there wasn't any fish. The federal science was such that it couldn't distinguish the extinguishing of various local stocks because of the assumption that it was a panmictic stock that was on average in the Gulf of Maine.
Panmictic species come together in one area to reproduce, like eels in the Sargasso Sea. Atlantic cod don't work like that. They reproduce within their own traditional bays and inlets. But at the time, cod were assessed at the scale of the entire Gulf of Maine, and not much was known about populations at a local scale. The Downeast region was among the first to feel the strain, but its fishermen, being relatively few and quite remote, held little political power in the regulatory system.
The meetings happened near Gloucester, near New Bedford, where there were big boats and large numbers of angry fishermen who could come to the meetings easily within an hour of their house. Whereas for an owner-operator from eastern Maine, you've got a 5 or 6 hour drive. So you get up in the middle of the night to get to the meeting. Your crewman doesn't have a day's pay because you're down at the meeting. You go to the meeting, you get 15 minutes comment time, you say your piece, you can't stay, you have to go back. And by that time, you've had a 20-hour day, and you may miss the next, if you, depending on your age, you may miss the next day's fishing. Your crewman loses 2 days. You don't feel as if you had an impact. You didn't have an impact. No one was saying, well, let's go down and find out whether there's any fish.
Up till this point, knowledge of local fishing grounds had been kept relatively secret. That helped keep people from away from catching local stocks. Different ports had different areas they specialized in, and it wasn't easy to get information about where to set your net down the coast. That changed when the government implemented catch reporting, gathering data on where fishermen caught fish and how much they landed there. According to Robin, big fishing companies from southern New England got a hold of the data.
Once there was reporting, somehow the big fleets from Portland and New Bedford just happened to show up. And the data was supposedly secure, but it wasn't secure at all.
Many of Maine's ground fishermen switched to other fisheries, including lobstering. For those who stayed in the fishing industry, faith in the federal management system was incredibly thin.
And their attitude toward the feds was that bumper sticker, National Marine Fisheries Service, killing fishing communities since 1977, which they had. That is what happened with groundfish in eastern Maine.
That was in the 1990s. Since then, the government has struggled to manage a collapsed cod fishery. Matt McKenzie served on the New England Council from 2013 to 2022. He's the professor from the top of the episode.
People built businesses on the assumption that there would be fish there. And when that issue gets kicked up, they get scared. They get mad, and they vent that. And that makes, it makes perfect sense. Ultimately, making decisions and regulatory processes is a human theater. And you have to consider the humanity of the people that whose lives your decision will affect.
Matt says there were times he had to make a choice, preserve fish stocks or preserve livelihoods. These were never easy decisions for him. The New England Council has had difficulty maintaining many of the stocks in its care. Flounder, pollock, and herring, among others, sport only a shadow of the fishermen that used to harvest them. Cod is the same.
We have not done well for cod. So does the system work? Biologically, on balance, not really. There are some success stories. We need more of those. Does the system create a transparent record by which we know who is doing what to the ecosystem, well, in that case, it does work. But if there's no natural resources left to fish, having a transparent system to manage them is kind of moot.
It is such a rigid system.
Robin again.
And because the entitlements are built on the old idea of a Pan-Mikuk stock, you've got people entitled to fish the whole Gulf of Maine, and the people who survived are the ones who fish at the whole scale of the whole Gulf of Maine. It's going to be a Herculean task even to try to allow anyone at a smaller scale to catch a fish.
In 2003, Robin co-founded the Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries. The organization aimed to address science, management, and policy questions impacting local fishermen. One of Robin's key goals was to set the stage for small-scale operations to return to the ground fishery.
I tried for 15 years with Maine Center for Coastal Fisheries to set up both the interest and advocacy and also the policy structure to make that possible. And it did not work. I'm looking for a dialogue where we say, hey, we can overfish these things. We aren't without impact on the system. And if we have impact, what the hell do we do to keep ourselves from ruining this for our grandchildren?
The fact is, we are the grandchildren. We are the ones dealing with stocks who are a shadow of their former selves. By Robin's estimate, there are perhaps half a dozen people in the state of Maine with permits to catch cod. But once upon a time, thousands of people lined the railings of boats, landing cod with baited hooks, and made a living. We can no longer rely on environmental or technological factors to keep us in check. Where codfish are concerned, the future is largely up to us. Thank you for tuning in to this episode of Coastal Conversations, looking at the history of the New England cod fishery. Next month, we'll be taking a look at lobster, its management, its future, and its stakeholders. If you'd like to hear that and other episodes of Coastal Conversations, join us on the fourth Friday of each month at 4 p.m. for information, stories, and conversations about the issues and people of the Maine coast. That great music you're hearing in the background is called A Following Seat and was composed and performed by Paul Anderson. Thank you to Karen Alexander, Bill Leavenworth, Matthew McKenzie, and Robin Alden for agreeing to share their perspectives. And thank you to Galen Koch and Natalie Springle for their assistance in the production of this episode. My name is Tegan Paulson, and on behalf of Maine Sea Grant and in partnership with Skudik Institute and the First Coast, we wish you a good weekend.